I've recently been in the real message of the parables of Yeshua. The last opportunity I had to share with you, I actually spoke on something totally different to the parables. But I'm getting back on track. Track, I'll get it right there. Today, and I'm going to do this in two parts because it's very, very big. This subject is very, very big. And it's vitally important that we all understand what it was Yeshua was actually teaching in this particular parable of the Good Samaritan. And today, as you can see up here on the whiteboard, this is part one, and I have entitled it Historical Implications. Because if Yeshua is going to talk about a good Samaritan, we need to know why he emphasizes that the Samaritan was good, as opposed to the general feeling at the time as to why the Samaritans were generally not good. So I want to actually cover all of this today, not today, certainly over the next two occasions that I speak on the parables. But in our previous two lectures, just sort of backing up a little bit, on the prodigal son and the lost sheep and the lost coin, I tried to give a proper emphasis on the unsearchable riches of God's grace. And a love that God has in his character, in his nature, toward his creative, sinning creations. We are made, well, we were made originally, in the divine image of God. And God has created us with an imagination. Amos said it earlier. I've been talking about it for years. That word imagination is an interesting one. It's image, I, nation. So it's rather interesting. We actually do image that which we have around us, our world, our society, in which we live and move and have our being. But in the case of the parable of the lost sheep, yet our Lord does not emphasize, and I want to make this clear, and I don't know whether I actually made it clear, he doesn't emphasize the security of the 99 that are in the pen. That's not what he's interested in. He's already got them. He's happy with them. They're happy with him. It's the maverick that's gone off, and that's the one he'll go out of his way to try and locate and to rescue. To rescue. Now, that maverick sheep may not think that it needs rescuing. it broke away for a reason. But I wish to also make a comment on that parable. And I meant to talk about this, but I'd forgotten all about it until halfway through this week, and I went, I didn't even mention that. And that is that there is a story. Now, I heard this story when I was a kid, and you probably heard it too. That when the shepherd goes out after a maverick sheep, what he does is get that sheep and breaks its leg. Then he puts it over his shoulders and he brings it back to the pen. And this way, the sheep gets pain. It has a lame leg, broken leg. It has to then be bound up and stays there with the shepherd. And he has to feed it and comfort it and all that. And that sheep will therefore not stray again. I mean, this was what I heard when I was a kid. And I want to tell you that this legend from childhood is nothing but monumental crap. Absolutely. But it came... if you look at Luke 15, verse 5, it's all based on this assumption. Look at Luke 15, verse 5. When he finds the sheep, what's he do? He joyfully puts it across his shoulders and goes home. All right? It doesn't say he puts it over his shoulders because he's broken its leg. It doesn't say that. That's the easiest way of carrying a sheep. Stick it over your head, over your shoulders, and walk home with it. Yeah. Clearly. And he's going to go home. He's going to celebrate. And the parable says he celebrates. He calls in his friends and his neighbours, and they probably eat a sheep. That's the irony of the whole thing. Yeah. Sorry?
Roast lamb dinner.
Yeah, roast lamb dinner. So,
on the spit.
On the spit. But apparently this silly story originated with a particular false prophet, an individual called William Marion Branham, my brother Branham, way back in the 1940s and 1950s. And he had a radio program, who knows what else. But he also suffered from SPM, special person misconception. And he believed he was the Elijah to come. He believed he was a true prophet of God. And he believed he could fill the shoes of the seventh angel of the Laodicean church in the book of Revelation. So, you know, this fellow had a huge mental image of himself, which was not quite in perspective, to say the least. But he was also highly... Yes?
He had an enlarged imagination.
Well, that's very true. He had no bounds in his imagination.
Over imagination.
But he also was highly illiterate. Now, this is his sermon he gave way back in 8th of March, 1957. It's called The Good Shepherd of the Sheep. Quite an appropriate title. But I'm going to just read it out the way he said it, the way he gave this little sermonette. And, you'll understand what I mean by illiterate as we go. But thousands of people, even today, they all, you know, Brother Branham, he was right. Oh, rubbish. He was an idiot. All right, he says, I guess you've heard the story of the shepherd that broke his sheep's leg one time. Many little stories have been told about it. And was asked of the shepherd, did the sheep fall off of a mountain and do this? He said, no. Said, what happened? He said, I broke its leg. Said, why did you break its leg? Are you a cruel shepherd? He said, no, I love the sheep. But the sheep got to running away from me, and he kept straying out to itself. And I know the nature of sheep. And I know if they stray too far away, the wolf will get them. So I had to break the sheep's leg to keep it with me, to draw it to my bosom, to give it a little special food. And I'll be so kind of it that when its leg gets well, it'll never leave me anymore. Well, I can almost visualize Cartman. I can almost visualize Cartman dressed as Jesus in a white robe, whacking sheep, that's a bad sheep, you know, bang, bang, bang. And then hurling the holy hand grenade of Antioch at any detractors. All right? I can almost visualize it. I love Cotton. But he, apart from his grammatical illiteracy, he knew zero about sheep. He knew zero about them. You know, what can I say? I shouldn't be too hard on the man. He probably meant well. He probably had good intentions. But my attitude is, sheep, from what I know of as a child with cousins and all of that, that had livestock, cattle, sheep and all that, sheep know who they can trust. And sheep never forget a face. Do you know that? They never forget a face. And they have memory. And they know who hurts them. And they won't go near that person. All right? But what I didn't like about that parable by Brother Branham was that it perverted our image of God as the Good Shepherd. It perverted it. It was a retelling in diabolic form of Yeshua's parable. Yeshua made an emphasis on God's unconditional, I repeat, unconditional love and grace toward an unrepentant humanity. That's the point I have been emphasizing in the Prodigal Son lecture and also the Lost Coin and Lost Sheep. God has unconditional love and grace toward unrepentant humanity. He has to heal people first before they can repent. All right? That's what he's got to do. Now look at the lost coin. Same story. We don't find a housewife who has delight in the fact that she still has 9 coins out of the 10. All right? Woohoo! Still got 9. No. She gets the candle. She gets the broom. She sweeps. She's got a candle in the middle of the day. Why is that? Because in dark areas of the house, the candle will cause a glint on the coin. She'll find it. She gets on her hands and knees to find that coin. We are the prodigal son. We are the lost sheep. We are the lost coin. We really are. And God literally gets on his hands and knees to search diligently until he finds us. Think of it in those terms. Because that's why Yeshua gave the parables to begin with. He's talking about God, all right? He's talking about us as well. The divine nature of love lets nothing of value get lost. He will look for it until he finds it. We're also the pearl of enormous price. I'll cover that one pretty soon too, that parable. It's an interesting parable. But the nature of divine love, as one of my most favorite authors, Geddes McGregor, says, the nature of divine love will go to the uttermost ends of the universe to retrieve and save it. The missing sheep, the missing coin becomes all important. He says, so then is God's care for us. But here is something I didn't cover, and I want to make this clear. We have to understand that Yeshua in the prodigal son parable acknowledges the karmic principle. Now we all know what karma is, all right? Working everywhere and at the root of all things, but it does not exclude the operation of mercy and grace. Now, I've gone in through this in the past, particularly when I went through the series on mortality. All right, and the spirit in man. I talk very, very candidly on this principle that karma does not exclude the operation of mercy and grace from God. On the contrary, when we are overwhelmed by the burdens we have brought upon ourselves and see no way out but the weary process of reconstructing what we have destroyed, sometimes a door opens, ushering in a light in a new way. I don't know whether you've ever experienced that. I have. I've had that experience. Such is the gratitude and love engendered by the vision of this opportunity, says McGregor, that a flood of tearful remorse cleanses us, releasing us from the weight of our burden and letting us skip forward on our way. He's talking about the psychological release that we have when we come to terms with what we have done, and we go through a period of remorse. That remorse has a cleansing effect. It really does. And he says, for such a loving response brings us at once into tune with divine being whose heart beats forever with love for all. You see, as he sums that up beautifully. Without that sense of remorse, well, let me say this, that remorse can't even begin unless God heals us first. When he reaches in and heals us, we then have this response. And it is a response. It's a response to the gospel and all that the gospel is. We return to God. We do teshuva to God. But, and here's the but, as Geddes McGregor rightly understands, even, now listen to me here, because I'm going to repeat it twice, but this is how important it is. Even divine being cannot overcome in us the consequence of our karmic debt. Listen carefully to what I'm saying, not what I'm not saying. Even divine being cannot overcome in us the consequence of our karmic debt unless and until we overcome it ourselves by the outpouring of our love, born from the most profound spiritual anguish. Brethren, that is a most profound concept. Even divine being cannot overcome in us the consequence of our karmic debt unless and until we overcome it ourselves by the outpouring of our love, born from the most profound spiritual anguish. I want you to really think about that statement, because it is awesome. Any wonder Revelation is full of, to him that overcomes, will I do this. To him that overcomes, will I do that. But unless we have gone through that anguish of mind and heart and soul and spirit and being, we're not on our way back to God at all. We're on our own way in a fool's paradise thinking we've got it solved. I've been there. So have you. Achieving spiritual attainment entails a special inner anguish and an experience of a deep and pitiful sense of alienation from the ultimate source of that to which we refer to as perfection, or infinite love, or infinite intelligence. In other words, we have to become conscious of our utter lostness. And most Christians never get to that place. They just go through this, believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and you will be saved. And they just, off they go, parroting it away. They do not come to terms with their lostness. They don't come to terms with the fact that they are out of God's realm of grace to begin with. Otherwise, you know, there would be no lostness. And I think Yeshua experienced the same sense of alienation and anguish in his humanness, devoid of the spiritual majesty that he had from eternity. Something to think about, what he must have felt as a human being. Firstly, the severance from God the Father, Mother, God, okay, the Father, Mother, God, a sense of severance from God in the divine miracle of conception. Now, a lot of people don't want to think about that one, but it's a reality. Then a second severance, as he pulsated his body out of the womb and down through the birth canal into the light of transient human existence. And then finally, when Yosef, or a midwife, cut the umbilical cord and left his salted body helpless and bound in tight swaddling clothes, lying in a manger with straw as his entirely unfamiliar bed. So here is this process of alienation from all that he once was, all that he once experienced. In one way of looking at it, Yeshua himself had become the prodigal son. Think of it that way. You might go, well, that's a bit too, that's radical. Well, stop and think. What did the prodigal son do? He did every evil thing imaginable. And his father still brought him back. What did Yeshua do? He hung on the tree, took upon himself, transmogrified into sin itself. Now, in my view, that qualifies him to understand Reuben, Leah, James, myself. And hallelujah is it is. Absolutely. He understood and understands who we are. Because he's coming to understand himself through us and our lostness. And Yeshua went through all of that for you and me. That blows my mind. It staggers my imagination. And in fact, there's an even more, that's another alienation that experience, that Yeshua experienced, isn't it? His death. So his whole life was a series of alienating factors. And I wanted to clear those points up before we got into the next parable. I find that sometimes, you know, after you give a lecture, you sit back and you reflect and you think, loose string here, it's untied over there, it's untidy over here. And I just wanted to sort of just sum all that up so that we get a proper and more balanced perspective on the whole thing. So now we're here at the Good Samaritan. Here's the next parable we're going to go through. And I want you now to turn over to Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10. And beginning in verse 25, behold, a certain lawyer stood up, tempting him. Now, incidentally, that tells you immediately where the setting was. In the temple. In the temple. A certain lawyer stood up, tempting him, saying, "Teacher, having done what, shall I inherit life eternal?" I love the way lawyers pose questions. They really know what they're... if you've ever been in the company of a lawyer, you know they're already geared to destroy you, to undermine you, to pull the rug out from beneath you.
I'm sure it was a lawyer in the Garden of Eden wrapped around that tree.
Probably. "Teacher, having done what, shall I inherit life eternal?" And he said to him, "What's written in the law? How do you read it?" I love Yeshua. Yeah. Answering a question with a question. And he answering said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your understanding, and your neighbor as yourself." Now this lawyer understood the concept of not only the Deuteronomic law, but the Levitical purity code as well. He understood all that. He said to him, "You've answered right." There you go. "You've answered right." So the guy sits back up. "Yep. This do and you shall live." But Yeshua has set him up. He set up this little pompous drip. And he said, "Okay. The game's in your court. The ball's in your court." The lawyer says, desiring to justify himself. You see, the lawyer knows, the lawyer hears what comes out of your mouth, but the lawyer hears what doesn't come out of your mouth too. He looks at the subtext. So he, desiring to justify himself, said to Yeshua, "And who is my neighbor?" That is an astonishing response, because, you know, who is your neighbor? Who is your neighbor? Now, we Christianized all these years later, we can answer blah, blah, blah. But back then, different story.
Canaanite wasn't a neighbor.
The Canaanite was not a neighbor. And the Sinai law said you get out there and exterminate her. Right? So Yeshua had to change a few things in that regard. And in fact, you know, if you went and slept with your neighbor's wife, and he was a Jew and she was a Jewess, you committed adultery. But you could go down the street and find a Canaanite woman and had a ball. But that wasn't adultery. Now think about it. That's how the rabbinic understanding went back in the Second Temple period. So who's my neighbor? Yeshua said, a certain man. He starts to tell him a story. I love that. "Sit down, child, and I'll tell you a story. A certain man descended from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of bandits, who also, having stripped him and inflicted wounds, went away, leaving him in a half-dead state. And a certain priest happened to go down that way, and seeing him, passed on the opposite side. And in like manner also a Levite, being at the spot, came and looked at him and passed on the opposite side. But a certain Samaritan journeying came to him, and seeing him, was moved with compassion, and came up to him and bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, and having put him on his own beast, took him to an inn and took care of him. And on the morrow, as he left, taking out 2 denarii, he gave them to the innkeeper and said to him, 'Take care of him, and whatever you shall expend more, I will render to you on my return.' Which now of these 3 seems to you to have been neighbor of him who fell into the hands of the bandits?" And the lawyer said, well, he that showed him mercy. And Yeshua said to him, go, and you do the same. Now, I'm going to leave the parable right at that point, because his command to that lawyer has astonishing implications. And I'm going to cover those implications in my next lecture on this subject. But the usual Christian meaning of the parable is that the Jews of the Second Temple period hated the Samaritans, and that the Samaritans retaliated with even a deeper, brutal disregard toward their Jewish neighbors. And that's quite true. But then Christian interpretation insists that this parable views the Jews as having no real appreciation of the meaning of faith and works, which is a nonsense. And that therefore the more humane Samaritan, and here is where anti-Semitism or Semitism, if you wish, comes in, was accepted by God for his expression of love toward a Jew who had been beaten and almost pummeled to death. This is the view. The religious Jews particularly were rejected in their ignorant, unsympathetic state by God himself. That's how they view it. And therefore, we all need to become authentic spiritual Samaritans, helping our fellow man and woman when he or she is in need. So that's the general Christian interpretation. And in fact, there was even when I was a child, there was even a group of people like the Red Cross called the Samaritans. And they used to go around, you remember that? They used to go around helping people and all that.
It's the last Samaritan's purpose.
That's right. So, what we need to do before we do anything about understanding the parable is to understand a little bit of the background of why the Jews and the Samaritans didn't get on. I think this is most important. To understand the parable, we need to know who the Samaritans were, in my humble opinion. You see, well, not so humble, depending how you look at it. They claim to have been half Jews. Is that correct?
No.
Thank you. But where did they come from? Why did the Jews and the Samaritans hate each other so vociferously during the Second Temple period? And without even considering the anagram, now look, have a good look at this. And you go home and you work this one out yourself. I'll put it up here. The Samaritan, I think that's correct, is that correct? The Samaritans. There's the term, the Samaritans. Now the anagram of this, I know you're all waiting with bated breath, is this. And remember, anagrams are never wrong. I always like to make my lectures interesting. Satanism heart. Alright? Satanism heart. That's what the Samaritans means in an anagram. So who were the Samaritans? And why would the anagram be Satanism heart? Well, I'm going to tell you. And we're going to revisit history so I can tell you. Okay. According to the historical record, yeah, I know anagrams are never wrong. God sent his prophets to ancient Israel, warning them of impending danger of violent invaders who were going to destroy the northern kingdom of Israel. After the death of Solomon, there were two major leaders of the kingdom of David. One was Rehoboam and one was Jeroboam. There was a civil war, and one lot broke away from the people of God. 10 tribes went north. They became known as the kingdom of Israel, or the kingdom of Samaria, or the kingdom of Ephraim. All right, Ephraim was the major tribe of the 10 tribes, and Samaria was their capital city, and that became linked to the region. And so it became the kingdom, the northern kingdom of Samaria. And they had gone against the Torah, the Sinai Torah. So God said, you don't repent, I'm going to allow the Assyrians to come in and they're going to conquer you and take you into captivity. And they just went, sank into the most debauched kind of activities you could possibly imagine. And in fact, all the prophets that God sent, they slew. They slew. And the depth of decadence to which they sank, despite the prophetic utterances and warnings, is legendary. But you know what? God sent a man called Shalmaneser into that region, and he conquered nations all around the place, heading toward Israel. Israel didn't think twice. They kept believing that God was going to be there because, you know, he was their God. They were the chosen people. Shalmaneser comes in and he invades Israel. He dies in one of the expeditions, and a man called Sargon takes power, the Assyrian king, Sargon II. And he finishes what Shalmaneser began, and he conquers Israel and takes the 10 tribes into captivity. Now, when the Assyrians began to invade, many of the Israelis or Israelites fled south down to Judah, and they were given protection, asylum in the kingdom of Judah. And now that collapse of Israel occurred in the year 721 718, those years in the 718 BCE. Alright, so 700 years before the birth of Yeshua. Now, these people, these Israelites, the Bible says, are going to once again return to the land. Now, you might say, well, is that happening already? The answer is yes, it is. Because many of the survivors migrated or emigrated into Russia, into Kashmir, into Afghanistan, into those areas around that region. And many of them were found in the area of the Caucasus. That's just where the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea exist, just in there, around into the Dardanelles. And that area in there, many of them migrated into that area. But you know what? 2 Kings 17:23, if you want to make a mental note on paper, 2 Kings 17:23 says that all the Israelites were carried away. If they weren't destroyed, if they didn't escape, they were carried away to Assyria. There was none left, it says in the same chapter in verse 18, there were none left except the tribe of Judah only. So they were totally and completely obliterated as a people. But the southern kingdom of Judah remained intact for another 130 years. Now this is all history. Perhaps boring, perhaps exciting. Depends how you look at it. But the extermination programs, when they were completed, and the Assyrians used the most horrendous methods to bring a conquered people into subjection, including impaling victims through the anal canal, right up and through the chest cavity. And they would literally be in big spikes for days on end before they would finally succumb and die. But they knew exactly how to put those spikes through so they would miss the vital organs. They were experts at cruelty. Now, some of the Assyrians are found today in Germany. Surprise, surprise, surprise. And some of the hostilities that occurred in the Second World War we're all very aware of. What we now understand from research that has gone on about the ancient Assyrians is that when the Assyrians conquered a nation and did their public displays of cruelty and so on to subject people, they stripped them naked. They stripped all the captives naked, which the Nazis also did. Because once you've lost your clothes, you become vulnerable and pliable. People say, all those Jews lining up to go into the showers, all naked. Yeah, they were naked. The Nazis knew what they were doing. They become defenseless once you lose your clothes. So, which is rather interesting. But the Assyrians, when they transported people out of their land and back to Assyria, some of those areas that they conquered contained millions of people. You stop and think about 700 years before the birth of Christ, and the kind of planning that would go into the removal of millions of people, even under ancient conditions, it staggers the imagination. But the Assyrians had a policy, and that policy was deportment, all right, and importing other conquered nations into the area that they had just conquered. So in other words, they had people uprooted out of their lands, taken to somewhere else, implanted over there, and others taken from theirs and put into other cities that they had conquered. And this way, the Assyrians were able to keep total control of their empire with a handful of people in government. It's astonishing. Displacement, replacement policy. And the people who the Assyrians brought in to the cities of the Israelites, now emptied, were people who were Neo-Babylonian in their stock, right? And Syrian, Syro-Phoenician, those kind of peoples. And in fact, if you look at 2 Kings 17, I should have got you to go over there earlier instead of just saying make a mental note on paper. If you go to 2 Kings 17 and look at verse 24, 2 Kings 17, verse 24, Ezra is writing this, and Ezra tells us the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and from Kuppah and from Avar and from Hamath. And incidentally, Hamath can also be Hamas. It's rather interesting. And from the Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they possessed the land of Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof. Now, a man called Oded, a historian, in his Mass Deportations and Deportees in the Neo-Assyrian Empire, says that most would fail to realize that this custom of exchange peoples, which is a matter of historical curiosity, numbered into the millions. So this is what I was saying before. People don't seem to grasp the fact that, you know, when the Assyrians conquered nations, they would sometimes transpose millions of people at a time into various areas of their Assyrian empire.
And then they would then work for their livelihood, they'd work for the state.
Work will make you free.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
The sign that's outside Auschwitz.
Yeah. Well, they just get richer and richer.
Absolutely. So these Babylonish Syro-Phoenicians gave descent to the Samaritans at the time of Yeshua. So these people that came in and occupied the northern kingdom of Israel, now without any Israelites up there, they took over the city, and they became known as the New Israel, if you want to call it that, because they believed that if the God of the land had cast out these people, and we now have occupied their positions, then we have replaced them, and we are now the true Israel. All right, and this is why they call themselves Samaritans, meaning the people of the land of Samaria. Yeah. So it was an original idea about replacement theology that suddenly surfaces way back then. But it's rather intriguing to my mind that by the time of Nero, the Emperor Nero, by the time of Nero, the Samaritans had numerically increased to such an extent that their centers of population extended right around the Mediterranean Sea. Now, that's a huge area. And these included vast populations of Samaritans in Alexandria, in Egypt, and also in Rome. I find that fascinating. Now, I'm very, very glad to have a book on my shelf called A Dictionary of the Bible, written in 1884 by a man called William Smith, and he was quite a scholar. And he said this: the new Babylonian emigrants were idolaters who worshipped a strange medley of divinities. God's displeasure was kindled, and they came under continuing attack from wild creatures, particularly lions, which had increased to a great extent before their entrance upon the land. In other words, with Israel in the land, wildlife was kept under control. Okay, it was eco-friendly, you might say. But when they were deported, the cities lay waste for quite a while. And during that period, wildlife multiplied. All right. So, they're explaining their miserable condition to the king of Assyria. He dispatched one of the captive priests, that's one of the Israelite priests that went back to Assyria, to teach them how they should fear the Lord. The priest came, and in the language of the sacred historian, they feared the Lord and served their graven images. So here immediately is a syncretistic type of religion emerging in Samaria by these people, the Samaritans. They feared the Lord. In other words, the priest went back and he taught them the Torah. And to this day, Samaritans over there in that region of the world, in Samaria, keep the Torah. They have the Torah, the five books of Moses, which they claim was their prophet. Okay? They don't have any other scriptures of the Hebrew canon. They do have the Torah, and they say, this is our book. This is the Samaritans today. But notice, they feared the Lord and served their graven images, both their children and their grandchildren, as did their fathers, so they do unto this day. Now you'll find that in verse 41 of the same chapter, 2 Kings 17. Now Smith continues, at the time of the Jewish return from Babylonian exile, so that's now 130 years later, the Samaritans desired to be allowed to participate in the rebuilding of the temple at Jerusalem. Now the Jews had a policy. Solomon said, we'll allow the Phoenicians to our north, the Lebanese people and all of that, they can come in and they can help with the temple. But we're not going to have these rat bags, these Samaritans who claim to be the new Israel, having anything to do with our temple. And I think that was a correct policy, because you could never trust a Samaritan. Now,
the Lebanese had the wood.
And they had the cedars of Lebanon, absolutely. So, but on being refused, the Samaritans threw off the mask and became open enemies, frustrating the operations of the Jews throughout the reigns of two Persian kings. The feud grew year by year more inveterate. Then he says, about 409 BC, a certain Manasseh, a man of priestly lineage, obtained permission from the Persian king Darius to build a temple on Mount Gerizim for the Samaritans. The animosity of the Samaritans became more intense than ever. They did everything in their power to annoy the Jews. Their own temple on Gerizim they considered to be much superior to that of Jerusalem. There they sacrificed the Passover. Toward the mountain, even after the temple on it had fallen, wherever they were, they directed their worship. There's Gerizim. Now, if you're in Alexandria in Egypt, or in Rome, or in Britain, you would worship toward Gerizim. All right? Like the Arab today, they worship toward Mecca. To their copy of the law, they arrogated an antiquity. Now, listen to what Smith says. This is most important to understand. They arrogated to themselves, in other words, they had no right to have it. They said, we have an antiquity that goes right back. Moses was our prophet. The law of God came to Moses. They refused to accept the fact that they were imports and that they had literally taken over where Israel left off. When it suited them. When it suited them. To their copy of the law, they arrogated an antiquity and authority greater than attached to any copy of the law in the possession of the Jews. The Torah was their sole code. They rejected every other book in the Jewish canon. The Jews, on the other hand, were not more conciliatory in their treatment of the Samaritans. The Samaritans claimed to partake of Jewish blood, especially if doing so happened to be in their interest. All right. Now, how could they do that legitimately? Well, as the Assyrians had deported the Israelites and replaced the Israelites with the Samaritans, there were those who had escaped into Judah who felt free now to go back into Samaria and try and take up where they had left off, where their families had left off. So those few who did return to Samaria naturally began to intermarry with the Samaritan people. So it became, according to the religious authorities of Samaria, it became a legitimate exercise in race what's the word? Assimilation. All right. So, this is how they viewed things right down to the time when Yeshua wanted a drink at Jacob's well. Now, I want you to turn over to John chapter 4. Because this is a most intriguing account. Now, I've gone all through this before. Many, many times I've covered this material. But you know what? It's always new. It always comes afresh. If you have a look at verse 3, Yeshua left Judea, this is chapter 4 of John, and departed again to Galilee. But he needed to go through Samaria. So he came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now, Jacob's well was there. Yeshua, therefore, being wearied from the journey, sat thus by the well. It was about the sixth hour. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. Now, I'm not going to get into who this woman was. If you've heard my previous lectures, you know who it was. But I don't want to get sidetracked into this. But she's a very important Samaritan woman. And she figures in ecclesiastical history and with a particular gentleman who could work miracles. So, he sat by the well. A woman came to draw water. Yeshua said to her, "Give me a drink." Now, this is rather interesting. He doesn't say, "Please." He doesn't say, "Oh, hello today. How are you? And I'd like a drink. Would you draw me?" The Greek says, it's actually written in a blunt way, "Give me a drink." Okay. He wasn't very Christ-like. Christ. He just wasn't. "Give me a drink." All right. "For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food." That's an editorial comment, incidentally. I've already covered that the other day. "Then the woman of Samaria said to him, 'How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman?'" And then again, another editorial comment. "For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." All right? That's editorial. "Yeshua answered and said to her, 'If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, "Give me a drink," you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." You know what? Yeshua is the gift of God. He is the gift of God. This word evangelion, or evangelism, or if you want to, gospel, is not good news. It's great news. But more than great news, the actual word itself, evangelion, means message from heaven. A gift in the form of a message from heaven. And that's Yeshua. And he says to all of us, "You would have asked him and he would have given you living water." Living water. "The woman said to him, 'Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get that living water?'" Now notice what she says. "Are you greater than our father Abraham, our father Jacob?" So immediately she's decided, you know, we're not really Samaritans, we're the new Israel, we're the true Israel, we're the authentic Israel. Our father Jacob, Jacob wasn't their father. But she uses this ploy. "Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well?" You know, Jacob didn't do that. That's a lie. "And drank from it himself, as well as his sons and his livestock." Yes, you see, I've got a history, Yeshua. I've got a history. It goes all the way back to Jacob. And he gave us the well. And his family drank from it, and so do we. "Yeshua said to her, 'Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again, but whoever drinks of the water I will give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life.'" Let me tell you something. I gave an announcement today, and you all heard my announcement. I was told at my baptism not to expect anything. Not to expect tingles, no running up and down the spine, nothing like this. And when I came up out of that water, for my extremities, I had water coming through my body. It was coming out my brain. It was like out my ears. Something in me was wanting to speak, and I just controlled it. I just refused to let that out. But it was a fountain of living water, and the guy that had me under the water and baptized me, he said, "It's all right to be happy," because I was mortified, because everything they said, don't expect. I was coughing. But it rises up in me at times, and I just feel like a fountain. I just want to let it all out. And I think this is where we are now. We're at the point now where we have to grow. We have to get out there and let people know what gift we have. We, out of all the Messianic assembly, we who are so small, a few numbers, as it says in to Sardis, in the Revelation. Pardon? Few in number. You have not denied my name and all of that. Strengthen those things that remain, all those things. We are the only organization that actually understands grace. Others speak of grace, but mean mercy. To my mind, to my understanding, unless you understand grace, you will never be able to appreciate the person who lives next door. You'll never understand the person who rises up in anger at you. While God expects your response to be, I love you. Yeah, do what you want. But I'm not going to hurt you. We understand the implications of grace, which is a universal salvation. Every messianic organization we know of, and there might be some that aren't, but I don't know of any, have all adopted the Constantinian God of eternal hellfire.
Who would put, what is this, the Torah itself, say, do not put a stumbling block before the blind.
That's right.
Who's going to take the blind and throw them into a fiery furnace?
Exactly.
Besides a Nazi.
Exactly. Exactly. So we have come to the point where we have a fountain of water, we have it here, springing up into everlasting life, and we don't have the means by which to get this out. And it is the most frustrating situation that I find myself in. But we have come to this place where God has taken us on a serpent trail to this point. So I look back on it and I see the trail and I go, well, we're here because we're here because we're here. And God has brought us here. We're waiting. We're waiting. Hello, anybody home? So we have come to the point where we must grow or perish. So the woman said to him, sir, give me this water that I may not thirst nor come here to draw. You know, totally blind, totally materialistic, sees only the physical, doesn't see the spiritual realm. Amos was talking about that spiritual realm in his Parsha today, that we have to go through, we have to experience that. If we don't experience it, we're not converted. Bottom line. Yeshua said to her, go and call your husband and come here. Once you understand who this woman was, you'll know why he said that. And the woman said, I don't have a husband. Yeshua said, yeah, you're right. He says, you said well. Sorry, you have well said. I have no husband because you've had five husbands and the man you're living with at the moment is not your husband. In that you spoke truly. In other words, there was no commitment between the two. Sorry? That's right. So the woman said to him, I perceive you're a prophet. Now notice what she says next. I perceive you're a prophet. Our fathers, so here we go, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, our fathers worshipped on this mountain. What mountain? Gerizim. So where is Yeshua? On Gerizim. I find this interesting. Because people don't realize the Samaritans were waiting for their own Messiah to come. They waited for their Messiah. He was going to appear on Gerizim. So here is Yeshua on Gerizim talking to this woman. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. Well, the Jews did say that, but she's saying, you said. Well, when you look through this, Yeshua hasn't mentioned Jerusalem at all. So therefore, what we have here is an abbreviated account by John about what was going on that mountain between this woman and Yeshua. So, going on, Yeshua said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not even know. I love that response. Yes, you're worshiping, but you're blind. You don't know what you're doing. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming, and I'm going to leave that next bit out because that's editorial, when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit. Yes, he is divine consciousness itself. That's what he's saying. He is the vibrating energy of the universe. And those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. The woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming. Yes, she's talking about her Samaritan Messiah, the Tao. When he comes, he will tell us all things. Yeshua said to her, I who speak to you am he. So, Yeshua decides to put a little bit of syncretistic value into what he has to say too. He's saying, you're waiting for the Samaritan Messiah. Hello, I'm here and I'm a Jew. Josephus tells us, as we've just seen here in John chapter 4, Josephus tells us that the Samaritans claimed to be Israelites when it suited them, and at other times became the enemies of Jews when it suited them. He tells us that in Antiquities 11 and Antiquities 9. But Yeshua shut her mouth by distancing himself from her lies, her self-deception, her delusion. He distanced himself. He said, you worship what you don't even know. We've got people who are spiritual Samaritans in this very region. And they prayed, these particular people, what I'm thinking about, prayed for a messianic teacher to come and teach them. So God answered them. We got here and they came around and they said, we've been praying for a messianic teacher, a Jewish messianic teacher. We're so happy. But they didn't want to hear what the messianic teacher taught. They're Samaritans. They're Samaritans.
Can I ask something?
Yes.
It's interesting that throughout the Gospels, Yeshua comes in contact with women, and the women are always the symbol of the people. You know, he comes across the Lebanese woman, or the descendant of the Canaanite, the Syrophoenician, she's called as well, and her daughter's possessed. Okay, and by faith. You know, in essence, that woman almost speaks for all Canaanites. You know, when she says, sure. Yeah, we're the dogs of the Jews, and says, great is the faith, you're healed. Mm. Then you've got this incident on Mount Gerizim. We're dealing with a place that actually had a temple, and he's talking with this woman.
Yep.
I know it may be reading into a bit of symbolism, but is it possible that this was a controversy between himself and the Samaritans? And he talks about the five different husbands.
Yeah, we'll come to that in a sec.
It's not that the five different husbands are five different gods and the God they have now is not actually theirs anyway.
That's exactly right. That's where we're headed. Okay. So he tells them, you see, because the Samaritan Messiah was going to recover the sacred vessels of the temple, which they believe were hidden in Mount Gerizim. So Yeshua turns around and says, here I am, all right? You're looking for the hidden vessel, here I am. If you go to, you'll have a copy of this, the others won't. Ecclesiasticus, Jesus the son of Sirach, he says in chapter 50, verse 25 and 26, and it is scripture, that the Samaritans, like the Philistines, were abhorred by God. They were abhorred. Loved them, but couldn't handle them. And that's what it says in that. And Josephus mentions the animosity of the Jews and the Samaritans had, in his day, become so difficult, relations, that Herod went out of his way to marry a Samaritan woman in the hope that that marriage would bring about peace for the relations between them. Now, in the procuratorship of Coponius, the Roman procuratorship of Jerusalem or Judea, in the year 6 through to 9 CE, the Samaritans by night brought in a whole load of human bones and placed into the temple and cast these human bones right through the sacred precincts of the temple in Jerusalem. They did that to defile the temple. And that brought a flashpoint into existence, and so from that point onwards, the Jews had a big warning sign outside the temple. And if any Gentile comes near this place, we will kill you. All right? So that was the big... Paul referred to that sign. He said, through Yeshua, that's gone. He said, we're now a multicultural temple. A multicultural society, I guess, before multiculturalism was conceived. But that's what the early Christian community was all about. So, so after that situation occurred, Jochen Jeremias tells us the first century became a time of very strained relations between the Jews and the Samaritans. The old antithesis of North and South, Israel and Judah, was revived in all its sharpness. The Jews would not accept them as blood relations. And that's because these Samaritan peoples were not related by blood. Very clearly. That was why. But the fact is, what I'm trying to emphasize is just how bad it was to be labeled, identified with, or called a Samaritan. Really was. It's very, very hard to understand that. But when Yeshua then discusses a parable where you're dealing with a good Samaritan, people would have been, what? Well, he got their attention. Nothing else. He got their attention very quickly by mentioning a good Samaritan. But I did mention before verse 24 of Second Kings 17. I mentioned five cities, five areas, five regional areas where these people came from who occupied the cities of Samaria instead of the displaced Israelites. And I've mentioned the pretense of Yahweh worship that went on up there in Samaria. And of course now you've got a number of people called Samaritans over there, and they're lovely people.
There's only a couple of hundred there.
But you know what? We had a Samaritan come here, and he claimed to be Jewish. And he was a slime bag. I'm telling you now. And he wore his robes. Oh, it's all right, Glennis. I don't care if he's even listening to this. He wore his robes, and he had his little zitzit, and he had his kippah, and he came in, and he says, he knocked at the door one night, and he said, here I am! That's familiar. And I sort of went to the door, and I said, who are you? He announced himself and wanted to come in. So we let him in. Because then when he announced himself, I knew who he was. He came from up here at Surfers Paradise. So can any good thing come out of Surfers Paradise? But be that as it may, he came in and he came down. He said, could I have a glass of water? No, he didn't. He was rude. He said, give me a glass of water, just like you should. To you. And so, well, we got him a glass of water. We said, whoever gives a glass of water in the name of a prophet receives a prophet. You know, he was full of it. And later on, he confessed to not being a Jew, but an Israeli. His passport is Israeli. I am not Jew. I said, oh, so you're a Samaritan. Yes, I'm very proud of it. Yeah, fine. And what did he want? He came all this way, down to our house, imbibed of us, demanded this, demanded that, trod all over Glennis's emotions and feelings and mine as well, talked about the dogs that he was feeding up there at Surfers Paradise. Not dogs. These were Gentiles, exacting a tithe from them so he and his wife could get back to Jerusalem. I said, you can't tithe. It's illegal to tithe. The priesthood's no longer, yeah, I know, but dogs don't care. Thinking I was on his side. I don't understand the absolute audacity of this individual. But he came down ultimately for one reason. He'd heard from people who had been here that I had a copy of Hyslop's Two Babylons on my shelf and he wanted to borrow it. He couldn't get it anywhere, so he came all the way down to see if the Rav would give him, would loan him my copy of the Two Babylons. I said, mate, there's the door. There's the door. You know, Samaritans will, they haven't changed. That's my view. They haven't changed. So, Harnack, the church historian, had a lot to say about the Babylonian peoples who occupied Samaria. Stay away. He says, long before the appearance of Christianity, combinations of religion had taken place in Syria and Palestine, especially in Samaria. Interesting. And so far as the Assyrian and Babylonian religious philosophy, with its manifold interpretations, had penetrated as far as the eastern shore of the Mediterranean. That's in his History of Dogma, Adolf von Harnack. Very interesting. He understood that a new religion was emerging at that time. And intriguingly, the five heathen nations now occupying the once vacant cities of the Israelites brought their Assyrian and Babylonian gods into the Holy Land with them. And that's what Harnack was telling us. And the religion was a religion, as we've just read before in 2 Kings, where they feared the Lord. In other words, they called themselves the people of God, and they served their idols, their graven images. So here was a syncretistic religion way back in the day. So Yeshua had said, woman, representing the kingdom, and when you understand who she was, you'll know how she represented that kingdom of Samaria. He said, woman, you spoke truly. You've had five husbands. And as Amos was pointing out just a minute ago, and quite correctly, they represented, those five actual husbands, the tribes that came into the land. The five tribes. Now, it is rather interesting because each tribe had their own deity. Now, of course, on the whiteboard, everything's too small for you to read, but up here, we've got the five gods. The people who came specifically from the city of Babylon worshipped the goddess Sulcha Benot. The name of this goddess literally means the tabernacles or the tents of the maidens. The tabernacles, the tents of daughters, as another translation. Jones tells us in his Proper Names of the Old Testament, chapels were made of green boughs which the men of Babylon who had been transported into Samaria erected in honour to Venus, and where their daughters were prostituted by the devotees of that abominable goddess. It was a custom, he said, of Babylon, the mother of harlots, and therefore her sons did the same thing in Samaria. So the god that they worshipped, this goddess I should say, was the goddess who created a religion where she had select priestesses who worshipped her, worked with her, and all of that in this religion. And they were contained in nunneries. So if you say to somebody, where did nunneries come from? And they can't answer, you can tell them, as one who wants to show her that this was not necessarily something that originated with Roman Catholic doctrine, it had its origin way back in the day in Samaria. They were nunneries where the maidens would lose their virginity, sometimes as early as the age of 9, 10, 11. Okay, then you've got the Kuthites. This was the second tribe. They worship a god called Nergal. And Nergal was the one who burns others. In fact, that's what the name means. He burns others. And they burn for all eternity. Guess where we got the doctrine of eternal hellfire? From the Kuthites. And you know what? That can also be understood as Kushites. You know, and let's face it, Nimrod is the son of Cush. He is the god of hellfire. Then you've got Hamas or Hamath. They worship Ashima, the god of propitiation. And Ashima shed his blood for the atonement of his followers. But you know what? Our Lord shed his blood for the world. For the world, not just for his followers. And in fact, Ashima was the miracle-oriented sun god. And Ashima, when you read about his life, he was born on December 25th, and he died on a Friday and was resurrected as the new sun god on Sunday morning. All right, so this is where the original idea of the Easter tradition comes from. It comes from the worship of Ashima. And, of course, Christmas traditions along with that. He was, in fact, the ancient god Nimrod or Tammuz or Baal. All right? Then you've got, oh, incidentally, with Ashima, he finally surfaces around about the first century before the birth of Christ. He suddenly appears again in Persia and then down around the Mediterranean as his followers went down there. And he was called Mithra, or Mithra, if you wish. And it was so secretive, that religion of Mithra, or Mithraism, was so secretive, nothing exists except some iconography. Okay? Nothing, no writings, nothing. There's a silence that reigns from the beginning of the cult in 67 BCE to Vesuvius erupting in 79 CE. That whole period is silent about what they believed. But we know they took, on a Sunday, the Eucharist. They took the bread and the wine on a Sunday morning in honor of the propitiatious God, who was none other than Ashima. All right, then the Arbites, they worship, and we don't know very much about these gods and goddesses, but they worship Nepas, who was the queen mother of angels. Well, I've only got to look at that and go, uh-huh, Mary. All right, and of course, they worshipped another female deity called Tartak, who was, when you look at it closely, and I've got a whole lot of stuff here you can look at when you get on the board to prove it, but she was none other than Semiramis, the wife, mother of Nimrod. Then you had people who were the Sepharvites, and they worshipped Adram Melech, the sun god, who was identical to the god up here, Nergal, who burns people forever. And they also had Anan Melech, and he was the good shepherd. All right? He was the good shepherd. He was called the good shepherd. He went out of his way to find his disciples. Not the unconverted. He went out to find his disciples and put them over his shoulder. And there was some iconography that actually shows Anan Melech in the same pose as Yeshua. Incredible. Incredible. And these five gods and goddesses of the five Neo-Babylonian tribes that resettled in the region of Samaria finally gave rise to Roman Christianity. All right? No doubt about that. And the doctrinal platform was a pre-Christian counterfeit of authentic Christian teaching. The counterfeit never comes after the real event. The counterfeit always comes before the real event. That's what people don't realize. And so the stage was set way back in the day for such a thing to occur. I might just quote Cumont, Franz Cumont, in his Oriental Religions in Roman Paganism. He says that the sinlessness of Mithra was the goal of aspiration and effort of believers. They were obliged to guard with infinite precaution against defilements of their own persons and to wipe out all pollution by repeated lustrations, sacrificial acts of purification, penances, indulgences, speaking to priests about their sinful state. That was all done. Baptism wiped out moral faults. The purity aimed at was spiritual. They met regularly on Sunday morning and partook of a sacramental service of bread and wine. Tertullian deplored it and said, Satan imitates the sacraments of God. Can't argue with that. All right. In fact, rather interesting, the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, tells us that, where is it? Ashima was in fact the hairless he-goat. Okay? So the ancients used to worship this hairless he-goat who walked around on his back legs with a very giant, you know what. And this was the Azazel goat. No doubt about that. The Azazel goat. Very well. So, by the time Yeshua walked the earth, you find that the Samaritans are in fact keeping the Torah, the five books of Moses. So what happened to all this stuff? They weren't worshipping, they weren't doing this outwardly at all. So where did all that go? Let me tell you, it went underground. It went underground. Over in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 9, I want you to have a quick look at this. I'll finish this in a second. Revelation 3 and verse 9. In fact, if you look through Revelation chapter 2 and chapter 3, you will find references all the time that John is making to Samaritans who were subverting the truth of God and invading the Messianic assemblies. And in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 9, he looks up here. He says, I know your works in verse 8. Behold, I have set before you an open door. No man can shut it. You have a little strength, have kept my word, not denied my name. Behold, he says, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, who say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. I will make them to come and worship before your feet and know that I have loved you. Now, this is rather interesting, because as soon as Christians read synagogue, they go, oh, these are Jews. No. These are people who say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. We just read about that in John chapter 4. These are Samaritans. Did Samaritans have synagogues? Yes, they did. And they're being excavated all around the Mediterranean now, while we speak, and also in the Balkans. And it's rather interesting. They always claim to be Jews, which we've discovered is not true at all about them. They claim to be Jews. They're not. They are liars. But notice, to know that I have loved you. In other words, not them. There's a contrast. Contrast being made here by John about these people and about the true people of God. But Luke in Acts talks about the synagogues of the Jews, and so critics have said this was written in the 4th century or the 3rd century, the book of Acts, because, you know, he wouldn't have said the synagogue of the Jews. They're the only Jews. Only Jews had synagogues. Well, no, that's wrong. And there were synagogues in the very cities that Luke mentions in the book of Acts, which were Samaritan. Not Jewish. There are synagogues of the Samaritans and synagogues of the Jews. And so when Luke records Paul going to the synagogue of the Jews, he's differentiating it from the synagogue of the Samaritans in the same city. And once again, we have the Lucan Acts being verified by historians. All right. Now, in Asia Minor, which is now Turkey, under the Herodian house, all right, Asia Minor, all the cities, became a cesspool of Simonism. Now you might say, what is Simonism? Well, around about the time of Christ, a man inherited the mantle of the Babylonian mystery religion in Samaria, the Samaritan lodge, and his name was Simon, and he was the magus. He was a magician. He was a very clever man. He was the... I can't think of the guy's name now.
David Blaine
of his day. Now, he had been a student of John the Baptist, and John had baptized him. And then later on, Philip came along into Samaria. Simon heard about the Christian teaching, and he wanted to be a part of that as well. So Philip goes along and naively baptizes Simon. Philip does it, the evangelist. And later on, Peter and John come down, and if you read Acts chapter 8 very carefully, Acts tells us that he was known in all Samaria as the great power of God. So he was a sorcerer. And yet when Peter and John came down into Samaria and looked at all the people that Philip had baptized, none of them had received the Holy Spirit. So they prayed for the Holy Spirit to fall on them. It did. Intriguingly, Simon sees that and he says, I want that power. He said, can I become an apostle? Look, he pulls out his wallet. And he says, I'll give you all this. And Peter says in the Greek, to hell with you and your money. To hell with it. Now, that's pretty strong words. That's pretty strong words. And you'll find all that in Acts chapter 8. And of course, ever since then, that crime of offering money for a position of power within the hierarchy at Rome has been called simony, right, after Simon the Magus. But Simon endeavoured to put into operation another strategy. Even though he was rejected and heading to hell, he turned around and decided to plot to take over the messianic assemblies that had this power. And he tried his very level best, and you know what? He was behind the persecutions of the Christians in Rome when Nero went ahead and started to destroy the Christians in Rome, had them crucified and all that after the fire at Rome. It was Simon Magus who put the Jewish wife Poppaea of Nero, Nero's Jewish wife Poppaea, up to convincing Nero to destroy this sect. So as he went against them, he was able to send his henchmen into the assemblies pretending to be Christians, and they began to infiltrate the messianic movement. Very interesting strategy, and it worked. It worked. But all the early church fathers, Irenaeus, Justin, Hippolytus of Rome, Clement of Alexandria, Epiphanius, and Eusebius and others, they all document Simon Magus. It's a fascinating study when you get into the Anti-Nicene Fathers to read about this man. But he had a desire to understand the mystery teaching of Paul. Why? Because he was a sorcerer. He wanted that higher level of understanding, that higher level of knowledge. You find the Acts of the Apostles breaks off very rapidly, very quickly, in the middle of a sentence, in the middle of a verse, in the middle of a thought at the end of Acts, because something stupendous happened that brought it to an end in 62 AD. And that was the death of James and the persecution that occurred shortly thereafter. All right. Harnack, I mentioned him before, tells us that Simon's one big aim was to establish a universal Christian religion. That was what he wanted. Harnack says, Simon Magus proclaimed a doctrine in which the Jewish faith was strangely and grotesquely mixed with Babylonian myths. Yeah, see all that stuff I've got up here? His religion was grotesquely mixed, says Harnack, with Babylonian myths, together with Greek additions. The worship was a mystery. To this day, what you hear in the Roman Church is the mystery of this, the mystery of this, the mystery of that. In consequence of the widened horizon and the deepening religious feeling, finally, the wild syncretism, this fusing of religious beliefs and practices, whose aim, this is Simon Magus, whose aim was a universal, that is, Catholic, because that's what it means, religion, all contributed to gain adherence for Simon. And Dr. McGifford, great historian, says his effort to rival and surpass Jesus likely began after his contact with the Christians, as Luke records. His religious system was a syncretism of Jewish and Oriental, see, Oriental, there it is up there on the board, elements. It need not be supposed that when Simon broke with the Christians, he renounced all he had learned. It is more probable that he carried some of the Christian ideas with him, and he wove these into a system of his own. This system contained some of the later germs of Gnosticism. Thus he became a leader of a retrograde sect, perhaps nominally Christian, and certainly using some of the Christian terminology, but in reality anti-Christian, and exalting Simon himself to the central position which Christianity was giving to Jesus Christ. And you know, you stop and think, that's horrific. And yet the Christians were falling for it. And how come? He was doing miracles. He was a magus. He was a sorcerer. He was a magician. He could do the David Blaine trick. Make things appear and disappear, or appear to be real and be sleight of hand. Hastings' dictionary says, encyclopedia, it says the author or first representative of this baptized heathenism is Simon Magus, who unquestionably adulterated Christianity with pagan ideas and practices with the aid and with the sanction of Christianity to set up a rival universal religion. So, you know, there it is. And we know that Peter in Rome had to combat Simon Magus around 42 CE. In other words, Simon already had a group called Christians. And he was using that group to infiltrate other messianic assemblies. With the garb of Christianity, looking like Christians, speaking like Christians, even calling themselves the very apostles of Christ. And even John records that in the book of Revelation. He says they present as the apostles of Christ. Scary. They say they are apostles. He said, but they lie. Yes.
Interesting that in the non-canonical works, in the apocryphal Christian writings,
yes,
there are so many of the Acts of Peter, the Acts of Paul.
Well, even the Acts of Peter refers.
All refer, yeah, to Simon Magus,
that's
over,
right,
and over,
that's,
and over,
right,
again. Things that we don't have.
Well, that's all. But you know, this is the marvellous thing about Simon Magus. He was Simon the Magus. He was actually called by the Babylonian and the Chaldean title, the Peter. He was called Simon the Peter, Simon the opener of mysteries. Today, Rome says that Simon Peter was the first pope. I'm not going to argue with that. But it wasn't Simon Peter.
Shimon Kephas.
It's, according to Parkhurst's Hebrew lexicon, the title Tar literally means the opener of the mysteries of the vagina. Now go back a little bit to Israel in the wilderness, in a place called Peor, where they had sex with the dead. Remember, that whole area was a religion of Tar and Ptah, which was all about necrophilia. Right? And so disease spread right through the Israelite camp. Thousands died, thousands perished as a result of it. And it's rather interesting that here is Simon called the opener, the interpreter. And even interpreter has PTR in it, if you look at it very cleverly, because it opens up mysteries, the mysteries of Babylon. Okay, I'm going to skip some of that for you. I'm going to finish in a second. John writes against these Samaritan infiltrators. You'll find it through the Revelation in chapter 2 and 3. Have a good look at that. But he says in the first epistle of John, and I want to emphasize this, because this was only a short few years after the crucifixion and resurrection and the establishment of the Messianic assemblies after Pentecost. Only a few years. And he says in chapter 2 of 1 John, in verse 18, little children, he says, it is a last time. You have heard the Antichrist shall come. But even now there are many Antichrists, yeah, these followers of Simon Magus, whereby we know it is a last time. They went out from us. This is interesting. What Simon would do, would infiltrate the Messianic assembly, collect disciples, and then leave and take them with him. And he says this, they went out from us, but they were not of us. They didn't have God's Holy Spirit. They weren't truly converted. They were a secret order of subversives. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us. But that they might be made manifest that they were not of us. Now drop down to look at verse 22. I have written unto you, not because you know not the truth, but because you do know it. I love that. And that no lie is of the truth. Who is a liar but he that denies that Yeshua is the Messiah? Simon was presenting himself as the returned Christ. He is Antichrist that denies the Father and the Son. You read the Ante-Nicene Fathers and also the Clementine homilies and the recognitions. They talk about Simon's doctrines. He said he was both the Father and the Son, manifest again in human form. People were believing him. verse 26, these things have I written unto you concerning them that seduce you. That's what John's letter is all about. And all the way through the first epistle, John speaks of them and we or us. Us against them. So all the way through, you can read it yourself. Rather fascinating. And you know, when you go further down through through the writings of John, if you have a look at 2 John, if you look at 2 John, 2nd epistle, John directs his circle of worship by authority. He says, do not allow these false ministers or any members of their congregations to enter your home. That's what he's saying. And he says in verse 9, whoever transgresses and abides not in the doctrine of Christ has not God. If there come any to you and bring not this doctrine, that's John's doctrine, receive him not into your house, neither bid him goodbye, or may all go well with you. Shabbatov! Don't say that ever to a Gnostic Samaritan. Okay? Don't do it. Now, look at verse 12. Many things I would like to write. Now look what he says. I would not with paper and ink, but I would prefer to speak face to face. Why? Because he had a well-founded intuition that his letter would be intercepted by some of those who were of that false church, if you want to call it a church. In 3 John, verse 13, you'll find a reference there that he needs to keep certain things undercover. I find this fascinating. Verse 14, he has friends, but he doesn't mention them by name because he wants to suppress the names. Now you might say, look, you're too conspiratorial. Maybe I am. But I see a lot in here.
It's not
yeah, he doesn't name them. I see a lot in here that was happening in that age. But you know what? John does mention one of the infiltrators. He mentions one of them. In 3 John, look at verse 9. He said, I wrote to the assembly. That's the assembly of God. But Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence, please notice that, doesn't receive us. Now here's John and his band of disciples. John was the closest companion of Yeshua, and he's the last apostle, last surviving apostle. They wouldn't even receive him. They're going, go away, we don't want to know you. Wherefore, if I come, I will remember his deeds which he does, prating against us with malicious words. And the Simonite Gnostics were masters at deceit and oratory. Prating against us with malicious words, and not content therewith, neither does he receive himself the brethren. If you look at verse 2, 5, 7, and 8, you will find that John sends the brethren, and he's kicking them out. He's refusing to allow them in. And forbids them that would receive the brethren. Forbids them. Okay? It's like, you know, here we are, a bunch of Messianic Christians here, and the Apostle John sends his people down, and here am I, a Simonite, saying, where anybody here that says hello to them or lets them in, you're out. Shocking. He says, forbids them that would receive the brethren and cast them out of the community. There it is, verse 10. So people were being cast out of the community of God, all because they understood these people came from John. And this guy, Diotrephes, said, nah, I'm not having it. So John was on his way there. He was going to take care of this fellow. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to see what he did. So, Christians were being excommunicated in the face of the Apostle John. Unbelievable situation. So, this explains why John spent so much of his time in his first epistle, called the Epistle of John, to rehash the basics of the word which they had from the beginning. That's what he says. If you look at 1 John chapter 1, verse 1, 3, 5, and 7. 1 John chapter 2, verse 13, 14, and 24. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 11. And 3 John verse 5. And I know you've written all that down very quickly in shorthand. He keeps going back to the word that they had from the beginning. And that's why he emphasizes that if Christians knew the truth, they did not need that any man teach them again the fundamentals. especially the fundamentals, with a new twist in doctrinal understanding and grassroots interpretation. But that new twist did come. It was accepted wholesale, and the churches of Christendom have accepted it and taught it ever since. Simon, the Samaritan Magus, was so successful, for the next two centuries, church fathers had to combat his theology, which had infiltrated the various Roman churches in their diocese, and it even penetrated, as a doctrine, the theology of the bishops themselves. And it stayed that way right through until Pope John the 23rd came out on his balcony and, for the first time ever, lifted up the medieval reverted cross of Christ, the black Christ, the crucified grotesque figure on this cross that was part of medieval witchcraft and sorcery. So finally, a Rosicrucian pope occupied Rome. Pope Paul, same story. And right down to this present day, the popes that rule from Rome are the Sufis. They're not genuine Christians at all. In 325, at the infamous Council of Nicaea, Constantine established a new church. It took 325 years, you might say, well, not quite, but thereabouts, for the Simonites, the followers of Simon the Magus, to infiltrate the church and to take it over. But they never succeeded until our 20th century, our recent 20th century. But the infamous Council of Nicaea saw Constantine establish a new church, which he called the New Catholic Religion. And in one famous edict, the emperor made it abundantly clear that if Christians did not join this new church, they would be declared heretics. Think about what that would have incurred. This is why you had tens of thousands of Christians fleeing the bounds of the Roman Empire into the Balkans and into Europe proper, and away from Rome itself. Over to the Balkans, down into the Asia Minor region again, up into France, all over the place, into Britain. They went everywhere they could to get away from this mad new church. So in Yeshua's day, just to finish, it was the vilest epithet you could imagine to be called a Samaritan. It was the lowest curse anyone could give you. It is during this volatile later Second Temple period that Yeshua uses the example of a good Samaritan to teach one of the most profound truths ever delivered to the Jewish people and to the religious authorities. Now, the Mashiach, as a controversialist, goes without saying. But he now becomes the pale, he goes beyond the pale of religious scrutiny by announcing the new covenant. And to do so, with its implications in relation to the Sinai covenant, to do so, to actually announce it and to say, I'm setting it in concrete, he used a despised Samaritan, a parable about that Samaritan, to achieve it. And Christians have missed it all together. And this is why I thought today we would look at the historical implications first of what Samaritanism was all about, so that we can understand how Yeshua could use such an ugly, horrible, despicable race of people to create a platform on which to declare the new covenant about God's grace. Are there any questions on any of that? Okay.